Space Kate reporting from another exciting day at the International Space University Space Studies Programme 2012, and we've had a really interesting debate about the ethics of space and or our activities in space, in fact. And once again, I've stolen one of our panellists. It's Noel Hinners. You have had a very wide and varied career, and I'm especially keen to talk to you about your Apollo stuff, but how do you best like to be introduced to the world?
Just the way of knowing... I like to think that I have been extremely lucky and fortunate. I was born in 1935, and there's a writer called Malcolm Gladwell who looked at when people were born and opportunities. And he happened to pick 1935 as a year. First, it was low birth rate during the Depression. And we came, quote, of age in the late 50s when space all of a sudden became the thing. So getting out of graduate school in the early 1960s when the Apollo programs just started, luck of timing. Luck has so much to do with the opportunities that come. Just, you know, if I'd been born in 1945, I wouldn't have had the same opportunity. So unbelievably fortunate. And to work with fantastic people who were so dedicated to what they were doing, that became just the overarching goal. We're going to do it. We've been given this charge, we've been given adequate funding, let's go do it. And it was such an endeavor, I just look back as that being the highlight, and that got me going into the rest of the space program.
And you've held some pretty lofty positions at NASA.
They were positions of responsibility, but there's a good reason for that. I'm incompetent, technically.
And is that all it takes to get you to the top?
Well, it takes a little something else. But I do like to talk about that on occasion. I am not a detail worker problem solver. There are so many people around who do that better, much better than I can. So right from the very beginning, my approach was to surround myself with the most talented technical people I could find and leave them alone. They do wonderful things and make me look good.
So there's still hope for me.
Absolutely. The technique of people, that I'll call it management, is so important. And so often, too many people forget that or don't develop that capability and talent. But it's easy to get everybody else to do your work.
So you were born at the right time, and then you actually got to work on the Apollo program. I mean, it's an iconic program. Everybody knows about Apollo, even if they don't know much about space. What was your role in the Apollo program?
Early on, I worked my way into becoming the scientist in the program, working very closely with the NASA folks at headquarters and at Johnson Space Center. On the Apollo site selection. I had a couple of wonderful people working with me on that. So there was an Apollo site selection committee that I chaired for a while that would look at all the diverse possibilities of sites we could go to. And part of our job was to challenge the engineers, who, you know, safety first, which is understandable, that's their job. But we'd push for things such as landing at Tycho down in the southern part of the moon or on the lunar far side.
And how were you making these choices? I mean, were you just spreading big maps out on the table and saying, that looks nice? Or
a lot of it was spreading the maps and the photographs from the Lunar Orbiter program on the table and trying to interpret what we saw in terms of the geology. The intent was to go to geologically diverse sites within the capability of the Apollo program. There was, say, no point of going back to the same kind of site Apollo 11 landed at. Just get more of the same stuff.
And did you choose that one?
No. The Apollo 11 sites were selected based totally on the engineering approach, where is the safest place we could go, and lay out a series of sites depending on the launch window. So we had very little input to the sites on Apollo 11. But after that, there was no, quote, reason to go back. We'd done, met Kennedy's goal, and so why do you want to go back? Well, the only reason to go back was for the science. We had all the hardware, the Apollo program was structured on the belief that it might take all those spacecraft to succeed with the very basic landing. So the fact that it worked the first time, oh my goodness, now we've got all this neat hardware around, let's use it. So the whole post-Apollo 11 program was based on the fact that 11 was so successful that it freed up tremendous assets that went put to good use for exploration.
So when you were watching a mission where you'd chosen the lunar landing site, how did you feel just before the landing? I mean, did it ever worry you? Like, oh no, what if I've chosen the wrong bit of the moon?
No, we had probably undue confidence that we were going to someplace different. We didn't always know what was there, but said, it's not like the one we've just been to. And one time we got totally faked out. The Apollo 16 site was interpreted by the geologist to be a kind of highlands material. And when we got the samples back, we said, whoa, this is not what we thought it was going to be. In a sense, that's neat. When you do science and you get some tremendous surprise, that's always good. It means you're not as smart as you think you are, and now you've learned something.
And there is always more to learn. How did you feel when the Apollo program ended? Did you feel upset that since then we've not been back to the moon? Is there more that we should have done?
No, I've never been upset because we did so much more than I ever thought we could. And there are so many other places in the planetary system to go to, so that did not particularly bother me. And there's still a discussion goes on today about how you put the moon in the context of the evolution of planetary systems, particularly, of course, the Earth-Moon system. Active discussion on that.
Now that we're looking at going forth to Mars, and obviously they have to select sites for the rovers to land, not people just yet, how different do you think the site selection is when they're looking at Mars now? Do we have a lot of new technology that's changing the way they did it compared to what you did?
Absolutely. For Apollo, all we had was black and white photography from the Lunar Orbiter program and very little else. On Mars, the amount of data from our remote sensing is incredible. There's the European mission, several US orbiters are up there doing essentially geochemical kinds of experiments from orbit. So our information base on the surface of Mars is so much more extensive than it was on the moon. In fact, almost too much so. It has made it, well, we've got these four high priority sites for the MSL mission that's going to land in August. That's difficult to make a decision. If there weren't that much, you'd say, it doesn't matter where you go, let's go there. But now, no, we've got to go there. No, we've got to go there. So the discussions are very emotional and, what's the right word? Animated, yeah. And any of them, they're all good sites, so we can't go wrong in that sense.
I mean, do you still feel the same sense of excitement with rovers going to Mars as you did when you saw people going to the moon? Or is it a completely different thing because it's robotics?
It's a totally different thing, but as I think I may have said there in one of those questions, we develop a rapport with our robots. So even though they're not people, some of the people who've designed these and made them have put so much of their lives into these things that they are like their little kids. So they have gone themselves, in a sense, to Mars and are down there. I talked to Steve Squires, who was the principal investigator for the two rovers down there, the MIR missions. And you could all see Steve, like Hal Mazursky, who I talked about, is there on Mars with his rovers.
It's kind of the way that people would talk about shuttle and the different shuttles having their personalities, and everyone has their own favorite shuttle that they've flown on or had some connection to. And it's interesting when you talk, everybody has my favorite Discovery, Diva Discoverer, as she became known because she didn't launch on time for her last flight. But everyone seems to have their own kind of connection, even though looking at it in another way, they are just hulking lumps of metal and machinery.
Yeah. I had an interesting discussion. Probably now almost 25 years ago, with Erwin Shapiro, who was head of the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory at Harvard. And I gave a talk advocating human exploration of Mars. And Erwin said, "No, I don't understand why you're pushing that." He said, "We send our robots." And he said, "When you think about it, robots are extensions of ourselves. And just as good in his view, and a heck of a lot less expensive than sending the humans." And it was his philosophy that you would identify with this robot if you created this robot, nursed it along and nourished it, and then launched it out there, you were sending an extension of yourself.
But there are very few people who actually get to create, nurse, and nourish the robots. And
right.
I think you'd struggle to find people who would be able to name the first rover that landed on the moon, whereas if you ask them the first person... Okay, we're in exalted company, which got slightly lost, and they rediscovered it recently, I believe.
Is that right?
I think so. I'm sure I saw a talk about that somewhere. I know that they were searching for it because it got lost, didn't it?
I don't recall getting lost. No.
I don't know. Maybe I've made that up. I will go and look it up. Lunokhod. I know that one, but it is different. People do tend to identify with humans because then they can think, I wonder how I would feel if that was my foot, whereas if it's your probe or sensor, it's not quite the same thing.
No, you're absolutely right. I believe you're right. I haven't quite developed a conviction that one can identify so well with a robot. There's no genetic link. They don't have DNA. Maybe someday, who knows? But,
Now, I can't let you go without asking... if you have one, for just a general personal story about Apollo. I've been talking to a lot of people through the shuttle program, and I hear sort of weird and wonderful tricks they would play on each other or interesting terminology that they would use. I mean, power cycling the shuttle sounded very technical to me until someone said, you just switch it off and switch it back on again. So I'm interested in collecting some of these kind of personal tales. So if there's anything that you remember from your time working on Apollo, I'd love to hear it. She says, completely putting you on the spot there.
Yeah, I've got to filter through so much history that I've almost forgotten much of. This does require some thought, but initially some of the things that pop into my head are getting a validation when the astronauts would land, get to a site. You know, did we do the right job of sending them to this site? And are they seeing things that we want them to find? And are there new surprises coming in these sites? And inevitably, there were things found and discovered that we had no idea. So getting surprised was a wonderful thing. That's the way science, technology advance. But like Jack Schmidt in the orange soil of Apollo 17, we had no idea there was any such thing. It turned out to be a volcanic glass on the Apollo 17 site. You couldn't see it from orbit.
Certainly not on your black and white photos.
That was one of the benefits of sending a geologist on that mission.
And was there not a mission where they were trying to get to a particular site and ran out of time and just missed the time to... I think they were walking up the side of a crater or something and they had to turn back before they collected all their samples? I'm trying to think. I should know this.
I'd have to reread the history.
So have you touched moon rock that came back?
Pardon?
Did you get to touch the moon rock and the samples that came back?
No, I did not. I wish... Yes, I did. I did touch the piece that went to the Smithsonian, the Air and Space Museum. Had a piece that you could touch.
Nice.
Yeah. And, of course, they had the Apollo 11 capsule there, too, which was neat.
Yeah, I've been to see it, and it's a wonderful thing.
Oh, Air and Space Museum. Fun place.
Great place.
I call that my three-year sabbatical.
So you actually worked there, didn't you?
Yeah, I was director of the Air and Space Museum for 3 years. That was fun.
life. Oh, yeah, you know, just chose the sites for Apollo to land, and then I, you know, spent 3 years at the Smithsonian.
Yeah.
Wow. Anything else I should know about?
Saying I wanted to be a chicken farmer. Some would say I've made it.
Well, thank you ever so much for spending a moment talking to me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.